Indeed, they has the advantage of embracing both sexes and feeling right in a wider variety of sentences. Through the ages, language mavens have deplored the way English speakers convert nouns into verbs. The following verbs have all been denounced in this century: to caveat, to nuance, to dialogue, to parent, to input, to access, to showcase, to intrigue, to impact, to host, to chair, to progress, to contact. As you can see, they range from varying degrees of awkwardness to the completely unexceptionable. In fact, easy conversion of nouns to verbs has been part of English grammar for centuries. It is one of the processes that make English, English. I have estimated that about a fifth of all English verbs were originally nouns. Considering just the human body, you can head a committee, scalp the missionary, eye a babe, nose around the office, mouth the lyrics, gum the biscuit, begin teething, tongue each note on the flute, jaw at the referee, neck in the back seat, back a candidate, arm the militia, shoulder the burden, elbow your way in, hand him a toy, finger the culprit, knuckle under, thumb a ride, wrist it into the net, belly up to the bar, stomach someone's complaints, rib your drinking buddies, knee the goalie, leg it across town, heel on command, foot the bill, toe the line, and several others that I cannot print in a family language book. What's the problem? The concern seems to be that fuzzy-minded speakers are slowly eroding the distinction between nouns and verbs. But once again, the person in the street is not getting any respect. Remember a phenomenon we encountered in Chapter 5. The past tense of the baseball term, to fly out, is flied, not flew. Similarly, we say ringed the city, not rang, and grandstanded, not grandstood. These are verbs that came from nouns. A pop fly, a ring around the city, a grandstand. Speakers are tacitly sensitive to this derivation. The reason they avoid irregular forms like flew out is that their mental dictionary entry for the baseball verb to fly is different from their mental dictionary entry for the ordinary verb to fly, what birds do. One is represented as a verb based on a noun root, the other as a verb with a verb root. Only the verb root is allowed to have the irregular past tense form flew, because only for verb roots does it make sense to have any past tense form. The phenomenon shows that when people use a noun as a verb, they are making their mental dictionaries more sophisticated, not less so. It's not that words are losing their identities as verbs versus nouns. Rather, there are verbs, there are nouns, and there are verbs based on nouns, and people store each one with a different mental tag. The most remarkable aspect of the special status of verbs from nouns is that everyone unconsciously respects it. Remember from Chapter 5 that if you make up a new verb based on a noun, like someone's name, it is always regular, even if the new verb sounds the same as an existing verb that is irregular. For example, Mae Jemison, the beautiful black female astronaut, out Sally rided Sally ride, not out Sally rode Sally ride. My research team has tried this test using about 25 new verbs made out of nouns on hundreds of people. College students, respondents to an ad we placed in a tabloid newspaper asking for volunteers without college education, school-aged children, even four-year-olds. They all behave like good intuitive grammarians. They inflect verbs that come from nouns differently from plain old verbs. So is there anyone anywhere who does not grasp the principle? Yes, the language mavens. Look up Broadcasted in Theodore Bernstein's The Careful Writer, and here is what you will find. If you think you have correctly forecasted the immediate future of English and have casted your lot with the permissivists, you may be receptive to Broadcasted, at least in radio usage, as are some dictionaries. The rest of us, however, will decide that no matter how desirable it may be to convert all irregular verbs into regular ones, this cannot be done by UKs. Nor can it be accomplished overnight. We shall continue to use broadcast as the past tense and participle, feeling that there is no logic for broadcasted other than one of analogy or consistency or logic, which the permissivists themselves so often scorn. Nor is this position inconsistent with our position on flied, the baseball term, which has a real reason for being. The fact, the inescapable fact is that there are some irregular verbs. Bernstein's real reason for flied is that it has a specialized meaning in baseball. But that is the wrong reason. See a bet, cut a deal, and take the count all have specialized meanings. But they get to keep their irregular pasts, saw, cut, and took, rather than switching to seed, cutted, taked. No, the real reason is that to fly out means to hit a fly, and a fly is a noun. And the reason that people say broadcasted is the same. Not that they want to convert all irregular verbs into regular ones overnight, but that they mentally analyze the verb to broadcast as to make a broadcast. That is, as coming from the much more common noun, a broadcast. The original meaning of the verb, to disperse seeds, is now obscure except among gardeners. As a verb based on a noun, to broadcast is not eligible to have its own idiosyncratic past tense form, so non-mavens sensibly apply the ad-ed rule. I am obliged to discuss one more example, the much vilified hopefully. A sentence like, hopefully the treaty will pass, is said to be a grave error. The adverb hopefully comes from the adjective hopeful, meaning in a manner of hope. Therefore, the mavens say, it should be used only when the sentence refers to a person who is doing something in a hopeful manner. If it is the writer or reader who is hopeful, one should say, it is hoped that the treaty will pass, or if hopes are realized, the treaty will pass, or I hope that the treaty will pass. Now consider the following. 1. It is simply not true that an English adverb must indicate the manner in which the actor performs the action. Adverbs come in two kinds, verb phrase adverbs like carefully, which do refer to the actor, and sentence adverbs like frankly, which indicate the attitude of the speaker toward the content of the sentence. Other examples of sentence adverbs include accordingly, admittedly, alarmingly, amazingly, basically, bluntly, candidly, confidentially, curiously, generally, happily, honestly, ideally, incidentally, intriguingly, mercifully, oddly, parenthetically, predictably, roughly, seriously, strikingly, supposedly, understandably. Note that many of these fine sentence adverbs like happily, honestly, and mercifully come from verb phrase adverbs, and they are virtually never ambiguous in context. The use of hopefully is a sentence adverb, which has been around in writing at least since the 1930s, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, and in speech well before then, is a perfectly sensible application of this derivational process. 2. The suggested alternatives, it is hoped that, and if hopes are realized, display four famous sins of bad writing, passive voice, needless words, vagueness, pomposity. 3. The suggested alternatives do not mean the same thing as hopefully, so the ban would leave certain thoughts unexpressible. Hopefully makes a hopeful prediction, whereas I hope that, and it is hoped that, merely describes certain people's mental states. Thus you can say, I hope that the treaty will pass, but it isn't likely. But it would be odd to say, hopefully the treaty will pass, but it isn't likely. 4. We are supposed to use hopefully only as a verb phrase and adverb, as in the following. Hopefully, Larry hurled the ball toward the basket with 1 second left in the game. Hopefully, Melvin turned the record over and sat back down on the couch 11 centimeters closer to Ellen. Call me uncouth, call me ignorant, but these sentences do not belong to any language that I speak. Imagine that one day someone announced that everyone has been making a grievous error. The correct name for the city in Ohio that people call Cleveland is really Cincinnati, and the correct name for the city that people call Cincinnati is really Cleveland. The expert gives no reasons, but insists that that is what is correct, and that anyone who cares about the language must immediately change the way that he, Yes, he, not they, refers to the cities, regardless of the confusion and expense. You would surely think that this person is insane. But when a columnist or editor makes a similar pronouncement about, hopefully, he is called an upholder of literacy and high standards. I have debunked 9 myths of the generic language maven, and now I would like to examine the mavens themselves. People who set themselves up as language experts differ in their goals, expertise, and common sense, and it is only fair to discuss them as individuals. The most common kind of maven is the word watcher, a term invented by the biologist and word watcher Lewis Thomas. Unlike linguists, word watchers train their binoculars on the especially capricious, eccentric, and poorly documented words and idioms that get cited from time to time. Sometimes a word watcher is a scholar in some other field, like Thomas or Quine, who indulges a lifelong hobby by writing a charming book on word origins. Sometimes it is a journalist assigned to the question and answer column of a newspaper. Here is a recent example from Ask the Globe. Question. When we want to irritate someone, why do we say we want to get his goat? J.E., Boston. Answer. Slang experts aren't entirely sure, but some claim the expression comes from an old racetrack tradition of putting a goat in the same stall as a high-strung racing thoroughbred to keep the horse calm. 19th-century gamblers sometimes stole the goat to unnerve the horse and throw the race, hence the expression, get your goat. This kind of explanation is satirized in Woody Allen's Slang Origins. How many of you have wondered where certain slang expressions come from, like she's the cat's pajamas, or to take it on the lamb? Neither have I. And yet for those who are interested in this sort of thing, I have provided a brief guide to a few of the more interesting origins. Take it on the lamb is English in origin. Years ago, in England, lambing was a game played with dice and a large tube of ointment. Each player in turn threw dice and then skipped around the room until he hemorrhaged. If a person threw 7 or under, he would say the word quince and proceed to turn in a frenzy. If he threw over 7, he was forced to give every player a portion of his feathers and was given a good lambing. 3 lammings and a player was quarreled or declared a moral bankrupt. Gradually, any game with feathers was called lambing, and feathers became lambs. To take it on the lamb meant to put on feathers and later to escape, although the transition is unclear. This passage captures my reaction to the word watchers. I don't think they do any harm, but A, I never completely believe their explanations, and B, in most cases, I don't really care. Years ago, a columnist recounted the origin of the word pumpernickel. During one of his campaigns in Central Europe, Napoleon stopped at an inn and was served a loaf of coarse, dark, sour bread. Accustomed to the delicate white baguettes of Paris, he sneered, "C'est pain pour Nicole," Nicole being his horse. When the columnist was challenged, the dictionaries say the word comes from colloquial German meaning farting goblin, he confessed that he and some buddies had made up the story in a bar the night before. For me, word-watching for its own sake has all the intellectual excitement of stamp collecting, with the added twist that an undetermined number of your stamps are counterfeit. At the opposite end of the temperamental spectrum, one finds the Jeremiahs, expressing their bitter laments and righteous prophecies of doom. An eminent dictionary editor, language columnist, and usage expert once wrote, quoting a poet, "As a poet, there is only one political duty, and that is to defend one's language from corruption. And that is particularly serious now. It is being corrupted. When it is corrupted, people lose faith in what they hear, and that leads to violence." The linguist, Dwight Bollinger, gently urging this man to get a grip, had to point out that the same number of muggers would leap out of the dark if everyone conformed overnight to every prescriptive rule ever written. In recent years, the loudest Jeremiah has been the critic John Simon, whose venomous film and theater reviews are distinguished by their lengthy denunciations of actresses' faces. Here is a representative opening to one of his language columns. The English language is being treated nowadays exactly as slave traders once handled the merchandise in their slave ships, or as the inmates of concentration camps were dealt with by their Nazi jailers. The grammatical error that inspired his tasteless comparison, incidentally, was Tip O'Neill's redundantly referring to his fellow colleagues, which Simon refers to as the rock bottom of linguistic ineptitude. Speaking of black English vernacular, Simon writes, "Why should we consider some, usually poorly educated, subculture's notion of the relationship between sound and meaning? And how could a grammar, any grammar, possibly describe that relationship? As for I be, you be, he be, etc., which should give us all the heebie-jeebies, these may indeed be comprehensible, but they go against all accepted classical and modern grammars, and are the product not of a language with roots in history, but of ignorance of how language works." There is no point in refuting this malicious know-nothing, for he is not participating in any sincere discussion. Simon has simply discovered the trick used with great effectiveness by certain comedians, talk show hosts, and punk rock musicians. People of modest talent can attract the attention of the media, at least for a while, by being unrelentingly offensive. The third kind of language maven is the entertainer, who shows off his collection of palindromes, puns, anagrams, rebuses, malapropisms, Goldwinisms, eponyms, sesquipedalia, howlers, and bloopers. Entertainers like Willard Espy, Dimitri Borgman, Giles Brandreth, and Richard Lederer write books with titles like Words at Play, Language on Vacation, The Joy of Lex, and Anguished English. These rollicking exhibitions of linguistic zaniness are all in good fun, but when reading them, I occasionally feel like Jacques Cousteau at a dolphin show, longing that these magnificent creatures be allowed to shake off their hula skirts and display their far more interesting natural talents in a dignified setting. Here is a typical example from Lederer. "When we take the time to explore the paradoxes and vagaries of English, we find that hot dogs can be cold, dark rooms can be lit, homework can be done in school, nightmares can take place in broad daylight, while morning sickness and daydreaming can take place at night. Sometimes you have to believe that all English speakers should be committed to an asylum for the verbally insane. In what other language do people drive in a parkway and park in a driveway? In what other language do people recite a play and play at a recital? How can a slim chance and a fat chance be the same, while a wise man and a wise guy are opposites? Donut holes. Aren't these little treats donut balls? The holes are what's left in the original donut. They're head over heels in love. That's nice, but all of us do almost everything head over heels. If we are trying to create an image of people doing cartwheels and somersaults, why don't we say they're heels over head in love? Objection. 1. Everyone senses the difference between a compound which can have a conventional meaning of its own, like any other word, and a phrase whose meaning is determined by the meanings of its parts and the rules that put them together. A compound is pronounced with one stress pattern, dark room, and a phrase is pronounced with another, dark room. The supposedly crazy expressions like hot dog and morning sickness are obviously compounds, not phrases, so cold hot dogs and nighttime morning sickness do not violate grammatical logic in the least. 2. Isn't it obvious that fat chance and wise guy are sarcastic? 3. Donut holes, the trade name of a product of Dunkin' Donuts, is intentionally whimsical. Did someone not get the joke? 4. The preposition over has several meanings, including a static arrangement, as in bridge over troubled water, and the path of a moving object, as in the quick brown fox jumped over the lazy dog. Head over heels involves the second meaning, describing the motion, not the position, of the enamorado's head. I must also say something in defense of the college students, welfare applicants, and Joe Sixpacks, whose language is so often held up to ridicule by the entertainers. Cartoonists and dialogue writers know that you can make anyone look like a bumpkin by rendering his speech quasi-phonetically instead of with conventional spelling. S-E-Z says, C-U-M, come. W-I-M-M-I-N, women. H-A-F-T-A, have to. C-R-O-O-S-H-U-L, crucial, and so on. Letterer occasionally resorts to this cheap trick in How to Recognize American Slurven, which deplores unremarkable examples of English phonological processes like coulda and could of, could have, forced, forest, granite, granted, next door, next door, and then, than. As we saw in Chapter 6, everyone but a science fiction robot slurs their speech. Yes, their speech, damn it. In systematic ways. Letterer also reproduces lists of howlers from student term papers, automobile insurance claim forms, and welfare applications, familiar to many people as faded mimeos tacked on the bulletin boards of university and government offices. In accordance with your instructions, I have given birth to twins in the enclosed envelope. My husband got his project cut off 2 weeks ago, and I haven't had any relief since. An invisible car came out of nowhere, struck my car, and vanished. The pedestrian had no idea which direction to go, so I ran over him. Artificial insemination is when the farmer does it to the cow instead of the bull. The girl tumbled down the stairs and lay prostitute on the bottom. Moses went up on Mount Sinai to get the Ten Commandments. He died before he ever reached Canada. These lists are good for a few laughs, but there is something you should know before you conclude that the teeming masses are comically inept at writing. Most of the howlers are probably fabrications. The folklorist Jan Brunvand has documented hundreds of urban legends, intriguing stories that everyone swears happened to a friend of a friend. FOAF is the technical term, and that circulate for years in nearly identical form in city after city, but they can never be documented as real events. The hippie babysitter, alligators in the sewers, and Kentucky Fried Rat, and Halloween sadists, the ones who put razor blades in apples, are some of the more famous tales. The howlers, it turns out, are examples of a subgenre called Xerox lore. The employee who posts one of these lists admits that he did not compile the items himself, but took them from a list someone gave him, which were taken from another list, which excerpted letters that someone in some office somewhere really did receive. Nearly identical lists have been circulating since World War I and have been independently credited to offices in New England, Alabama, Salt Lake City, and so on. As Brunvand notes, the chances seem slim that the same amusing double entendres are made in so many separate locations over so many years. The advent of electronic mail has quickened the creation and dissemination of these lists, and I receive one every now and again, but I smell intentional facetiousness. Whether it is from the student or the professor is not clear, not accidentally hilarious incompetence in howlers like adamant, pertaining to original sin, and gubernatorial, having to do with peanuts. The final kind of maven is the sage, typified by the late Theodore Bernstein, a New York Times editor and the author of the delightful handbook, The Careful Writer, and William Safire. They are known for taking a moderate common-sense approach to matters of usage, and they tease their victims with wit rather than savaging them with invective. I enjoy reading the sages and have nothing but awe for a pen like Safire's that can summarize the content of an anti-pornography statute as, "It isn't the teat, it's the tumidity." But the sad fact is that even a sage like Safire, the closest thing we have to an enlightened language pundit, misjudges the linguistic sophistication of the common speaker, and as a result misses the target in many of his commentaries. To prove this charge, I will walk you through a single column of his from the New York Times Magazine of October 4, 1992. The column had three stories, discussing six examples of questionable usage. The first story was a nonpartisan analysis of supposed pronoun case errors made by the two candidates in the 1992 U.S. presidential election. George Bush had recently adopted the slogan, "Who do you trust?" alienating schoolteachers across the nation who noted that who is a subject pronoun, nominative or subjective case, and the question is asking about the object of trust, accusative or objective case. One would say, you do trust him, not you do trust he, and so the question should have been whom, not who. This, of course, is one of the standard prescriptivist complaints about common speech. In reply, one might point out that the who-whom distinction is a relic of the English case system, abandoned by nouns centuries ago and found today only among pronouns in distinctions like he-him. Even among pronouns, the old distinction between subject ye and object you has vanished, leaving you to play both roles and ye as sounding completely archaic. Whom has outlived ye, but is clearly moribund. It now sounds pretentious in most spoken contexts. No one demands of Bush that he say, whom do ye trust? If the language can bear the loss of ye, using you for both subjects and objects, why insist on clinging to whom when everyone uses who for both subjects and objects? Sapphire, with his enlightened attitude toward usage, recognizes the problem and proposes Sapphire's law of who-whom, which forever solves the problem troubling writers and speakers caught between the pedantic and the incorrect. When whom is correct, recast the sentence. Thus, instead of changing his slogan to whom do you trust, making him sound like a hyper-educated Yaley stiff, Mr. Bush would win back the purist vote with which candidate do you trust? But Sapphire's recommendation is Solomonic in the sense of being an unacceptable pseudo-compromise. Telling people to avoid a problematic construction sounds like common sense, but in the case of object questions with who, it demands an intolerable sacrifice. People ask questions about the objects of verbs and prepositions a lot. Here are just a few examples I culled from transcripts of conversations between parents and their children. I know, but who did we see at the other store? Who did we see on the way home? Who did you play with outside tonight? Abe, who did you play with today at school? Who did you sound like? Imagine replacing any of these with whom. Sapphire's advice is to change such questions to which person or which child. But the advice would have people violate the most important maxim of good prose. Omit needless words. It also would force them to overuse the word which, described by one stylist as the ugliest word in the English language. Finally, it subverts the supposed goal of rules of usage, which is to allow people to express their thoughts as clearly and precisely as possible. A question like, who did we see on the way home, can embrace one person, many people, or any combination or number of adults, babies, children, and familiar dogs. Any specific substitution like, which person, forecloses some of these possibilities, contrary to the question asker's intent. And how in the world would you apply Sapphire's law to the famous refrain, who are you gonna call? Ghostbusters. Extremism in defense of liberty is no vice. Sapphire should have taken his observation about the pedantic sound of whom to its logical conclusion and advised the president that there is no reason to change the slogan, at least no grammatical reason. Turning to the Democrats, Sapphire gets on Bill Clinton's case, as he puts it, for asking voters to give Al Gore and I a chance to bring America back. No one would say, give I a break, because the indirect object of give must have accusative case. So it should be, give Al Gore and me a chance. Probably no grammatical error has received as much scorn as misuse of pronoun case inside conjunctions, phrases containing two elements joined by and or. What teenager has not been corrected for saying, me and Jennifer are going to the mall? A colleague of mine recalls that when she was 12, her mother would not allow her to have her ears pierced until she stopped saying it. The standard story is that the accusative pronoun me does not belong in subject position. No one would say, me is going to the mall, so it should be Jennifer and I. People tend to misremember the advice as, when in doubt, say so-and-so and I, not so-and-so and me. So they unthinkingly over-apply it, a process linguists call hypercorrection, resulting in mistakes like Al Gore and I a chance, and the even more despised between you and I. But if the person on the street is so good at avoiding me is going and give I a break, and if even Ivy League professors and former Rhodes Scholars can't seem to avoid me and Jennifer are going and give Al and I a chance, might it not be the mavens that misunderstand English grammar, not the speakers? The maven's case about case rests on one assumption. If an entire conjunction phrase has a grammatical feature like subject case, every word inside that phrase has to have that grammatical feature too. But that is just false. Jennifer is singular. You say Jennifer is, not Jennifer are. The pronoun she is singular. You say she is, not she are. But the conjunction she and Jennifer is not singular. It's plural. You say she and Jennifer are, not she and Jennifer is. So if a conjunction can have a different grammatical number from the pronouns inside it, she and Jennifer are, why must it have the same grammatical case as the pronouns inside it? Give Al Gore and I a chance. The answer is that it need not. A conjunction is an example of a headless construction. Recall that the head of a phrase is the word that stands for the whole phrase. In the phrase, the tall blonde man with one black shoe, the head is the word man, because the entire phrase gets its properties from man. The phrase refers to a kind of man and is third person singular, because that's what man is. But a conjunction has no head. It is not the same as any of its parts. If John and Marcia met, it does not mean that John met and that Marcia met. If voters give Clinton and Gore a chance, they are not giving Gore his own chance, added on to the chance they are giving Clinton. They are giving the entire ticket a chance. So just because me and Jennifer is a subject that requires subject case, it does not mean that me is a subject that requires subject case. And just because Al Gore and I is an object that requires object case, it does not mean that I is an object that requires object case. On grammatical grounds, the pronoun is free to have any case it wants. The linguist Joseph Edmonds has analyzed the me and Jennifer between you and I phenomenon in great technical detail. He concludes that the language that the mavens want us to speak is not only not English, it is not a possible human language. In the second story of his column, Sapphire replies to a diplomat who received a government warning about crimes against tourists, primarily robberies, muggings, and pickpocketings. The diplomat writes, "Note the State Department's choice of pickpocketings. Is the doer of such a deed a pickpocket or a pocket picker?" Sapphire replies, "The sentence should read robberies, muggings, and pocket pickings. One picks pockets. No one pockets picks." Significantly, Sapphire did not answer the question. If the perpetrator were called a pocket picker, which is the most common kind of compound in English, then indeed the crime would be pocket picking. But the name for the perpetrator is not really up for grabs. We all agree that he is called a pickpocket. And if he is called a pickpocket, not a pocket picker, then what he does can perfectly well be called pickpocketing, not pocket picking, thanks to the ever-present English noun-to-verb conversion process, just as a cook cooks, a chair chairs, and a host hosts. The fact that no one pockets picks is a red herring. Who said anything about a pickpocketer? The thing that is confusing Sapphire is that pickpocket is a special kind of compound because it is headless. It is not a kind of pocket, as one would expect, but a kind of person. And though it is exceptional, it is not unique. There is a whole family of such exceptions. One of the delights of English is its colorful cast of characters denoted by headless compounds, compounds that describe a person by what he does or has, rather than by what he is. Bird brain, blockhead, boot black, butterfingers, cutthroat, dead eye, egghead, fathead, flatfoot. Four eyes, goof off, hard hat, heartthrob, heavyweight, highbrow, hunchback, killjoy, know nothing. Lazy bones, loudmouth, low life, ne'er-do-well, pipsqueak, redneck, scarecrow, scofflaw, wetback. This list, sounding vaguely like a dramatis personae from Damon Runyon, shows that virtually everything in language falls into systematic patterns, even the seeming exceptions, if only you bother to look for them. The third story deconstructs a breathless quote from Barbara Streisand, describing tennis star Andre Agassi. He's very, very intelligent, very, very sensitive, very evolved, more than his linear years. He plays like a Zen master. It's very in the moment. Sapphire first speculates on the origin of Streisand's use of evolved. It's changed from the active to passive voice, from he evolved from the missing link to he is evolved, was probably influenced by the adoption of involved as a complement. These kinds of derivations have been studied intensively in linguistics, but Sapphire shows here that he does not understand how they work. He seems to think that people change words by being vaguely reminded of rhyming ones, evolved from involved, a kind of malapropism. But in fact, people are not that sloppy and literal-minded. The lexical creations we have looked at, let me caveat that, they deteriorated the healthcare system, Boggs flied out to center field, are based not on rhymes but on abstract rules that change a word's part of speech category and its cast of role players, in the same precise ways across dozens or hundreds of words. For example, the transitive to deteriorate the healthcare system comes from the intransitive the healthcare system deteriorated, in the same way that the transitive to break the glass comes from the intransitive the glass broke. Let's see then where evolved might have come from. Sapphire's suggestion that it is an active to passive switch based on involved does not work at all. For involved, we can perhaps imagine a derivation from the active voice. Raising the child involved John, active, consists of John was involved in raising his child, passive, consists of John is very involved. But for evolved, the parallel derivation would require a passive sentence, and before that an active sentence, that do not exist. Many experiences evolved John consists of John was evolved by many experiences, or John was evolved in many experiences. John is very evolved. Also, if you're involved, it means that something involves you. You are the object. Whereas if you're evolved, it means that you have been doing some evolving. You're the subject. The problem is that the conversion of evolved from to very evolved is not a switch from the active voice of a verb to the passive voice, as in Andre beat Boris, consists of Boris was beaten by Andre. The source Sapphire mentions, evolved from, is intransitive in modern English, with no direct object. To passivize a verb in English, you convert the direct object into a subject, so is evolved could only have been passivized from something evolved Andre, which does not exist. Sapphire's explanation is like saying you can take Bill bicycled from Lexington and change it to Bill is bicycled and then to Bill is very bicycled. This breakdown is a good illustration of one of the main scandals of the language mavens. They show lapses in the most elementary problems of grammatical analysis, like figuring out the part of speech category of a word. Sapphire refers to the active and passive voice, two forms of a verb. But is Barbara using evolved as a verb? One of the major discoveries of modern generative grammar is that the part of speech of a word, noun, verb, adjective, is not a label assigned by convenience, but an actual mental category that can be verified by experimental assays, just as a chemist can verify whether a gem is a diamond or zirconium. These tests are a standard homework problem in the introductory course that linguists everywhere call baby syntax. The method is to find as many constructions as you can in which words that are clear-cut examples of a category, and no other kind of word, can appear. Then, when you are faced with a word whose category you do not know, you can see whether it can appear in that set of constructions with some natural interpretation. By these tests, we can determine, for example, that the language maven Jacques Barzun earned an F when he called a possessive noun like Wellington's an adjective. The phrases that sound wrong are listed second. 1. Very X. Real adjective, very intelligent. Imposter, very Wellington's. 2. Seems X. Real adjective, he seems intelligent. Imposter, this seems Wellington's. 3. How X. Real adjective, how intelligent is he? Imposter, how Wellington's is this ring? 4. More X than. Real adjective, more intelligent than. Imposter, more Wellington's than. 5. A adjective, X adjective noun. Real adjective, a funny intelligent old friend. Imposter, a funny Wellington's old friend. 6. Un-X, real adjective, unintelligent, imposter, un-Wellington's. Now, let's apply this kind of test to Barbara's evolved, comparing it to a clear-cut verb in the passive voice like was kissed by a passionate lover. Odd-sounding constructions come second. 1. Very evolved. Very kissed. 2. He seems evolved. He seems kissed. 3. How evolved is he? How kissed is he? 4. He is more evolved now than he was last year. He is more kissed now than he was yesterday. 5. A thoughtful, evolved, sweet friend. A tall, kissed, thoughtful man. 6. He was uninvolved. He was unkissed by a passionate lover. Obviously, evolved does not behave like the passive voice of a verb. It behaves like an adjective. Sapphire was misled because adjectives can look like verbs in the passive voice and are clearly related to them, but they are not the same thing. This is the source of the running joke in the Bob Dylan song, Rainy Day Women, number 12 and 35. They'll stone you when you're riding in your car. They'll stone you when you're playing your guitar. But I would not feel so all alone. Everybody must get stoned. This discovery steers us toward the real source of evolved. Since it is an adjective, not a verb in the passive voice, we no longer have to worry about the absence of the corresponding active voice sentence. To trace its roots, we must find a rule in English that creates adjectives from intransitive verbs. There is such a rule. It applies to the principal form of a certain class of intransitive verbs that refer to a change of state, what linguists call unaccusative verbs, and creates a corresponding adjective. Time that has elapsed, elapsed time. A leaf that has fallen, a fallen leaf. A man who has traveled widely, a widely traveled man. A testicle that has not descended into the scrotum, an undescended testicle. A Christ that has risen from the dead, a risen Christ. A window that has stuck, a stuck window. The snow which has drifted, the drifted snow. A Catholic who has lapsed, a lapsed Catholic. A lung that has collapsed, a collapsed lung. A writer who has failed, a failed writer. Take this rule and apply it to a tennis player who has evolved, and you get an evolved player. This solution also allows us to make sense of Streisand's meaning. When a verb is converted from the active to the passive voice, the verb's meaning is conserved. Dog bites man equals man is bitten by dog. But when a verb is converted to an adjective, the adjective can acquire idiosyncratic nuances. Not every woman who has fallen is a fallen woman, and if someone stones you, you are not necessarily stoned. We all evolved from a missing link, but not all of us are evolved in the sense of being more spiritually sophisticated than our contemporaries. Sapphire then rebukes Streisand for more than his linear years. He says, "Linear means direct, uninterrupted. It has gained a pejorative vogue sense of unimaginative, as in linear thinking, in contrast to insightful, inspired leaps of genius. I think what Ms. Streisand had in mind was beyond his chronological years, which is better expressed as simply beyond his years. You can see what she was getting at, the years lined up in an orderly fashion, but even in the anything-goes world of showbiz lingo, not everything goes. Strike the set on linear." Like many language mavens, Sapphire underestimates the precision and aptness of slang, especially slang borrowed from technical fields. Streisand obviously is not using the sense of linear from Euclidean geometry, meaning the shortest route between two points, and the associated image of years lined up in an orderly fashion. She is using the sense taken from analytic geometry, meaning proportional or additive. If you take a piece of graph paper and plot the distance traveled at constant speed against the time that has elapsed, you get a straight line. This is called a linear relationship. For every hour that passes, you've traveled another 55 miles. In contrast, if you plot the amount of money in your compound interest account, you get a nonlinear curve that swerves upward. As you leave your money in longer, the amount of interest you accrue in a year gets larger and larger. Streisand is implying that Agassiz's level of evolvedness is not proportional to his age. Whereas most people fall on a straight line that assigns them X spiritual units of evolvedness for every year they have lived, this young man's evolvedness has been compounding, and he floats above the line with more units than his age would ordinarily entitle him to. Now, I cannot be sure that this is what Streisand had in mind. At the time of this writing, she has not replied to my inquiry. But this sense of linear is common in contemporary technopop cant, like feedback, systems, holism, interface, and synergistic, and it is unlikely that she blundered into a perfectly apt usage by accident, as Sapphire's analysis would imply. Finally, Sapphire comments on vary in the moment. This vary calls attention to the use of a preposition or a noun as a modifier, as in, it's very in, or it's very New York, or the ultimate fashion compliment, it's very you. To be very in the moment, perhaps a variation of the moment, or up to the minute, appears to be a loose translation of the French au courant, variously translated as up-to-date, fashionable, with it. Once again, by patronizing Streisand's language, Sapphire has misanalyzed both its form and its meaning. He has not noticed that, one, the word very is not connected to the preposition in, it's connected to the entire prepositional phrase, in the moment. Two, Streisand is not using the intransitive in with its special sense of fashionable. She is using the conventional transitive in with a noun phrase object, the moment. Three, her use of a prepositional phrase as if it was an adjective to describe some mental or emotional state follows a common pattern in English, under the weather, out of character, off the wall, in the dumps, out to lunch, on the ball, in good spirits, on top of the world, out of his mind, and in love. Four, it's unlikely that Streisand was trying to say that Agassiz is au courant or fashionable. That would be a put-down, implying shallowness, not a compliment. Her reference to Zen makes her meaning entirely clear, that Agassiz is very good at shutting out distractions and concentrating on the game or person he is involved with at that moment. So these are the language mavens. Their foibles can be blamed on two blind spots. One is a gross underestimation of the linguistic wherewithal of the common person. I am not saying that everything that comes out of a person's mouth or pen is perfectly rule-governed. Remember Dan Quayle. But the language mavens would have a much better chance of not embarrassing themselves if they saved the verdict of linguistic incompetence for the last resort, rather than jumping to it as a first conclusion. People come out with laughable verbiage when they feel they are in a forum demanding an elevated formal style, and know that their choice of words could have momentous consequences for them. That is why the fertile sources of howlers tend to be politicians' speeches, welfare application letters, and student term papers, assuming there is some grain of truth in the reports. In less self-conscious settings, common people, no matter how poorly educated, obey sophisticated grammatical laws and can express themselves with a vigor and grace that captivates those who listen seriously. Linguists, journalists, oral historians, novelists with an ear for dialogue. The other blind spot of the language mavens is their complete ignorance of the modern science of language. And I don't mean just the formal apparatus of Chomskyan theory, but basic knowledge of what kinds of constructions and idioms are found in English, and how people use them and pronounce them. In all fairness, much of the blame falls on members of my own profession for being so reluctant to apply our knowledge to the practical problems of style and usage, and to everyone's natural curiosity about why people talk the way they do. With a few exceptions like Joseph Emmons, Dwight Bollinger, Robin Lakoff, James McGauley, and Jeffrey Nunberg, mainstream American linguists have left the field entirely to the mavens, or as Bollinger calls them, the shamans. He has summed up the situation. In language, there are no licensed practitioners, but the woods are full of midwives, herbalists, colonic irrigationists, bone setters, and general purpose witch doctors, some abysmally ignorant, others with a rich fund of practical knowledge, whom we shall lump together and call shamans. They require our attention not only because they fill a lack, but because they are almost the only people who make the news when language begins to cause trouble and someone must answer the cry for help. Sometimes their advice is sound. Sometimes it is worthless. But still it is sought because no one knows where else to turn. We are living in an African village, and Albert Schweitzer has not arrived yet. So what should be done about usage? Unlike some academics in the 1960s, I am not saying that instruction in standard English grammar and composition is a tool to perpetuate an oppressive white patriarchal capitalist status quo, and that the people should be liberated to write however they please. Some aspects of how people express themselves in some settings are worth trying to change. What I am calling for is innocuous, a more thoughtful discussion of language and how people use it, replacing the Bubba Maces, old wives' tales, with the best scientific knowledge available. It is especially important that we not underestimate the sophistication of the actual cause of any instance of language use, the human mind. It is ironic that the Jeremiads wailing about how sloppy language leads to sloppy thought are themselves hairballs of loosely associated factoids and tangled non sequiturs. All the examples of verbal behavior that the complainer takes exception to for any reason are packed together in one unappealing mass and coughed up as proof of the decline of the language. Teenage slang, sophistry, regional variations in pronunciation and diction, bureaucratic bafflegab, poor spelling and punctuation, pseudo-errors like hopefully, badly crafted prose, government euphemism, non-standard grammar like ain't, misleading advertising, and so on, not to mention deliberate witticisms that go over the complainer's head. I hope to have convinced you of two things. Many prescriptive rules of grammar are just plain dumb and should be deleted from the usage handbooks. And most of standard English is just that, standard, in the same sense that certain units of currency or household voltages are said to be standard. It is just common sense that people should be given every encouragement and opportunity to learn the dialect that has become the standard one in their society and to employ it in many formal settings. But there is no need to use terms like bad grammar, fractured syntax, and incorrect usage when referring to rural and black dialects, though I am no fan of politically correct euphemism, in which, according to the satire, white woman should be replaced by melanin impoverished person of gender, Using terms like bad grammar for non-standard is both insulting and scientifically inaccurate. As for slang, I'm all for it. Some people worry that slang will somehow corrupt the language. We should be so lucky. Most slang lexicons are preciously guarded by their subcultures as membership badges. When given a glimpse into one of these lexicons, no true language lover can fail to be dazzled by the brilliant wordplay and wit. For medical students, zero belly, crispy critter, prune. Rappers, jaw-jacking, dissing. College students, stud muffin, veg out, blow off. Surfers, gnarlacious, geeklified. And hackers, to flame, core dump, crufty. When the more passé terms get cast off and handed down to the mainstream, they often fill expressive gaps in the language beautifully. I don't know how I ever did without to flame, protest self-righteously, to diss, express disrespect for, and to blow off, dismiss an obligation. And there are thousands of now unexceptionable English words like clever, fun, sham, banter, mob, stingy, bully, junkie, and jazz that began life as slang. It is especially hypocritical to oppose linguistic innovations reflexively and at the same time to decry the loss of distinctions like lie versus lay on the pretext of preserving expressive power. Vehicles for expressing thought are being crafted far more quickly than they are being lost. There is probably a good explanation for the cult of inarticulateness, where speech is punctuated with, you know, like, sort of, I mean, and so on. Everyone maintains a number of ways of speaking that are appropriate to different contexts, defined by the status and solidarity they feel with respect to their interlocutor. It seems that younger Americans try to maintain lower levels of social distance than older generations are used to. I know many gifted prose stylists my age whose one-on-one speech is peppered with sort of and you know. Their attempt to avoid affecting the stance of the expert who feels entitled to lecture the conversational partner with confident pronouncements. Some people find it grating, but most speakers can turn it off at will, and I find it no worse than the other extreme, certain older academics who hold court during social gatherings, pontificating eloquently to their trapped junior audiences. The aspect of language use that is most worth changing is the clarity and style of written prose. Expository writing requires language to express far more complex trains of thought than it was biologically designed to do. Inconsistencies caused by limitations of short-term memory and planning, unnoticed in conversation, are not as tolerable when preserved on a page that is to be perused more leisurely. Also, unlike a conversational partner, a reader will rarely share enough background assumptions to interpolate all the missing premises that make language comprehensible. Overcoming one's natural egocentrism and trying to anticipate the knowledge state of a generic reader at every stage of the exposition is one of the most important tasks in writing well. All this makes writing a difficult craft that must be mastered through practice, instruction, feedback, and, probably most important, intensive exposure to good examples. There are excellent manuals of composition that discuss these and other skills with great wisdom, like Strunk and White's The Elements of Style and Williams's Style Toward Clarity and Grace. What is most relevant to my point is how removed their practical advice is from the trivia of split infinitives in slang. For example, a banal but universally acknowledged key to good writing is to revise extensively. Good writers go through anywhere from 2 to 20 drafts before releasing a paper. Anyone who does not appreciate this necessity is going to be a bad writer. Imagine a Jeremiah exclaiming, "Our language today is threatened by an insidious enemy. The youth are not revising their drafts enough times." Kind of takes the fun out, doesn't it? It's not something that can be blamed on television, rock music, shopping mall culture, overpaid athletes, or any of the other signs of the decay of civilization. But if it's clear writing that we want, this is the kind of homely remedy that is called for. Finally, a confession. When I hear someone use disinterested to mean apathetic, I am apt to go into a rage. Disinterested, I suppose I must explain that it means unbiased, is such a lovely word. It is ever so subtly different from impartial or unbiased in implying that the person has no stake in the matter, not that he is merely committed to being even-handed out of personal principle. It gets this fine meaning from its delicate structure.